And that means it's episode 47 for August 21st in the year 2007. Sense of pattern. Anyway, our top six list is going to kick things off this week for you. It's about the last movies by directors. A look at the top six films that were the director's final movies. In the Film Buffs Dictionary, we'll have another word I can't pronounce this week. Aperture, which I may have accidentally gotten right just there. Sam will lead us through his obsessive fascination with the Tarzan series and our spotlight look at that. And we'll finish up with the finishing up of editing in History of Editing Part 2. I'm Stephen Keller.
And I'm Sam Stoddard. And, I think it's been a great all-movie talk run. I'm going to continue to stay on as host, but I'm going to be giving up my duties behind the scenes in directing the episodes. And we're going to turn it over to Stephen Keller, our very own Stephen Keller right here. Or a dolphin, one of the two.
Well, I know for sure the first thing I'm going to do is introduce more backwards-talking dwarfs.
Okay.
Because I think that our show's really lacked that, except for the David Lynch episode.
Yeah.
Back in episode 9, if you can remember back that far, we did a top 6 directorial debuts, so directors whose first movies were great. This week, we want to kind of do the counterpart to that, which is the top 6 directorial swan songs, which are great movies that directors went out on. I had a harder time with this list because I think what tends to happen is, in fact, a lot of directors have said this, it's a young man's game, and obviously there's exceptions. I mean, Clint Eastwood is as great a director as he's ever been now at the age of, I don't know, I think he's 120 this year, but, for the most part, you kind of lose your edge after a while, and great directors can wind up doing pretty mediocre things at the ends of their careers, so we're pretty interested in those exceptions where directors did great work at the end. So I'm going to kick things off with my number 6, and it's one that is pretty unknown. We've talked a lot about François Truffaut, not an unknown director, but his last movie, Confidentially Yours, is this great little homage to Hitchcock. Isn't that weird? He does an homage to another director as his last movie. He didn't know it was going to be his last movie, but he loved Hitchcock and periodically tried to do these little homages to him that sort of borrowed his thriller style. The great thing is that he does a great job with those movies, whereas a lot of other directors who borrow Hitchcock's style just don't get it.
De Palma.
What? Are you trying to say something?
Brian De Palma? No, nothing.
The cool thing about Truffaut is that he's such a brilliant director, but his natural movie, the typical Truffaut movie, you think of Day for Night or The 400 Blows, they're not at all anything like Hitchcockian thrillers. So it's really neat that he can take on Hitchcock and do a really good job with it. And Confidentially Yours is one of those, not one of his more celebrated movies, but for people who watch Truffaut, they definitely respect Confidentially Yours a lot. And it touches upon a lot of the Hitchcockian themes, and yet makes them a little bit Truffaut, too. So you've got a Hitchcockian thriller, mistaken identities and murders and bad guys chasing you and the cops, in a movie that's about Truffaut-esque relationships. What a neat thing to see.
Yeah, and especially appropriate given how influential Hitchcock was toward Truffaut, making movies and taking movies very seriously. Well, my number 6 pick is a very recent movie that it was strange how appropriate it is to be this director's final film. As I was watching it, I didn't expect it to be the director's last film. He died shortly after it was released, and that was A Prairie Home Companion from last year by Robert Altman, 2006. And it's a film that is, I think it was a little underappreciated. I think it deserved, more recognition than it got, though it was pretty well received. But, I mean, it's a movie that's all about show business and death and how you want to be remembered. Which, I guess makes sense given the fact that Altman was, in his 80s when he made this film. But he just seemed so healthy and he kept going and he was just cranking out movies like clockwork. I really had no inkling that this was going to be his final film when I saw it. And then, after it was released and he died, I was just really, really shocked that this guy who you would expect to, guy at that kind of advanced age shouldn't be that big of a surprise. But here it was just because Altman was so tirelessly always working and seemed so sharp and alert in interviews, that kind of thing. But it's a wonderful little film and it's funny and it's bittersweet and it's a great movie and a great movie to go out on.
Yes, and I would have possibly picked this for my list, but we actually did collaborate so that we could pick different movies to talk about and not overlap too much. But yeah, it's kind of hard sometimes to recognize the greatness of people's lesser works. Like I mentioned, Confidentially Yours by Truffaut. That would be a masterpiece by a lesser director, but it was Truffaut. And in this case, you think, well, it's Altman, A Prairie Home Companion, but I'm comparing this to Shortcuts and Nashville and MASH and stuff. But it really is a great movie. Don't let those bigger giants overshadow it. There is a great sense of humor, a great sense of freedom here, and yet also does capture the emotion of it's time is moving on. It's the end of an era. What a great way to compound the sense of nostalgia you already have for this show that's sort of, you know, out of its own time anyway. It harkens back to an earlier era, and yet we're compounding that nostalgia by actually putting it back in the past, potentially with the last broadcast of the episode. It's a great film, and I don't know that another director could have done it any better. My number five is a movie called L'Atalante, which is a French film from 1934 by director Jean Vigo. You know, it reminds me of A Prairie Home Companion now that it's almost similar, not in terms of story, but in terms of the feeling. It's a movie that tries to convey the sense of enjoying the moment and seeing the pleasantness of everyday life and just appreciating simple things. Here's the idea. This woman comes to marry a man who lives on a ship, and she lives there too, and it's just a great place to be. It's a pleasant life. There's a lot of music in the film, too. The film uses music in a way to enhance that kind of feeling. But she gets bored. She doesn't really see it and appreciate it as much as maybe he does. So she runs away to explore the exciting nightlife of Paris. And he gets all angry, so he just takes off, but then regrets that decision. And so we got this personal relationship about regret and loss and doing the wrong thing and realizing what you had after it's gone and all that stuff in an atmosphere that conveys the same feeling in some way. It's just a great film in that sense, but very subtle. If you're not really looking for a movie to express a feeling, if you want a big exciting story or rousing music or crazy comedy or whatever, you're not going to get that from this movie. But I think if you approach it in the right mentality, it really comes alive.
Yeah, L'Atalante is a great, great film that I would have picked if I had remembered it. I didn't realize it was Vigo's last film. He had a very short career. A much less obscure film is my number five pick, and it's The Ten Commandments, the 1956 version by director Cecil B. DeMille. There's actually two versions of this, both of them by DeMille, but this was his last film, and probably the one I'm going to go out and say that he's probably the most famous for. You know, this is that epic big-budget event with Charlton Heston as Moses, and I mean, at the time, just featured jaw-dropping sequences like the parting of the Red Sea and this huge, gigantic cast, and it's almost certainly one of the best-remembered of the biblical epics, and probably one of the better of the biblical epics as well. This one and Ben-Hur also with Heston, but not by DeMille. Great film, just full of striking imagery, and I think maybe, you know, DeMille gets kind of sometimes criticized today. He's maybe a little bit stiff, a little bit more focused on spectacle than on other things, but people didn't do spectacle much better than DeMille, and there's a reason why he's so famous, and it's very, very fitting that this was his final film, because it's one of the ones that he is most famous for. So that's The Ten Commandments, the version from 1956.
A very great film and a good pick there. My number four is, I would have picked that for my list, and perhaps instead of my number four pick, but I knew you were going to do it. My number four is The Comancheros by Michael Curtiz, who's maybe better known for directing things like Casablanca, you know, a little film like that. I actually associate him more with the black and white film noir, well, not really film noir, but definitely gangster-esque kind of movies from the 40s. But he ended his career on a Western made in 1961, starring, of course, John Wayne. He was in every Western, I think, for seven decades. He has a great set of co-stars here, too, Lee Marvin and Jack Elam and other people who just really, really color up a movie. I wouldn't say it's a great movie, but it's very good because it assembles just so much color and personalities, and it's just done very well. So you'd call it a very well executed Western movie that, you know, maybe doesn't break out and become an instant classic, but is certainly remarkable as a work of craftsmanship. And obviously, you know, John Wayne is a great actor, and he was cast in all the Westerns for seven decades for a reason. It's because he really, really has a powerful presence that you just can't take your eyes off. except maybe when Leave Marvin is the bad guy and they're having a fist fight or something, but, you know, pretty entertaining movie.
Hmm, interesting. I have not seen it, so I can't really comment on it, but number four, and I wonder if I'm stealing one from your list, because I know this is a movie that you really like, and it's the final film by director Joseph Mankiewicz, probably most famous for the film All About Eve from 1950. Well, his last film was a little movie called Sleuth from 1972, starring Michael Caine and Laurence Olivier, and just a wonderful little kind of strange thriller about a mystery writer and a guy in this English manor house, and to say much about it at all spoils it, but it's a great little psychological thriller, whodunit, kind of all rolled up into one, this real battle of wits between two really clever, really smart guys, just by two great actors just going at it. It's basically the two of them are going to be alone together for most of the film, and so we see this wonderful tour de force by both of them, and a really wonderful, weird directorial style that Mankiewicz brings to it. Sometimes Mankiewicz is best known as a writer, but he was also a director who, it's hard to classify him. You look at his filmography, a lot of varied things. I mean, this is a guy who did All About Eve, and also Guys and Dolls, and The Barefoot Contessa, a lot of variations on his movies, but Sleuth, a fun little film to go out on, and I feel like, did you not get this on your list, Sam?
I'll trade you a lot of land for Sleuth, and then we'll be even, huh? Yeah, I forgot about Sleuth, and I love it. Well, no, I didn't do that, but I did pick a pretty good movie for number three, actually a brilliant movie by Sergei Eisenstein, and the movie is Ivan the Terrible Part 2. That was his last movie, released in 1958, but actually filmed much earlier, in the early 40s, I think. That's when the first part was released. And he was working on a third part. It had a few scenes shot, but they were mostly destroyed, and he died anyway, so that never really saw the light of day. But there was this trilogy that was going to be a biography of Ivan the Terrible, and you don't really lose too much by not having the third chapter, except, you don't get that story, but it's not like it leaves you hanging or anything. The first two parts do each end on a pretty conclusive note as a chapter in his life, and part two, I would say part one and two are equally brilliant, but let's see, how do I describe why, though? Maybe I could give you a sense of it. If you think about Citizen Kane and what that means in terms of movie history, you got Orson Welles, who is he's not really inventing as much as you think. He's taking a lot of German Expressionist techniques, borrowing storytelling techniques, a lot of movie-making techniques, cinematography, all those things, and then just combining them in the most brilliant way imaginable. Eisenstein kind of did the same thing with Ivan the Terrible. This is a guy who pretty much invented editing practices, more or less you can credit him with that much.
Well, he's the guy responsible for the entire theory of montage, not just the specific what we think of as a montage today, but a guy who really, really researched and really worked hard at figuring out why editing works and what makes it work. There's this whole class of Soviet filmmakers that were basically doing the same kind of thing in the late teens, early 20s, just really studying editing, and that's, he really brought it to the forefront and really helped advance and create modern editing.
Yeah, and as Welles did in combining all these different techniques in an innovative way to make a masterpiece, I think Eisenstein did that same sort of thing with Ivan the Terrible, but he has his own sensibility. Obviously, he's not Welles, so don't draw the comparison too tightly, but Eisenstein really just made a masterwork in these Ivan the Terrible films. It's not something you'd watch for fun, but in terms of just the craft of film, this is brilliant.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about it. Just totally change gears here and talk about another director. You mentioned early on that directors frequently don't do their best work at the end of their lives, but my pick for number three is a director who started out really strong, and his name is Luis Buñuel, a Spanish filmmaker who teamed up with Salvador Dali, the great surrealist artist. And in 1929, they made a short film called Un Chien Andalou, which is a really famous surrealist short film. And Buñuel was very prolific, was going to be making movies really throughout the 30s and a little bit in the 40s. And then through the 50s, he's in Spain, he's down in Mexico. And by the end of his career in the 1970s, he's making films in France. and he made a couple of his most famous and well-respected films in France toward the end of his career, particularly The Discreet Charmer of the Bourgeoisie in 1972. But his last film is a pretty well-respected, though not quite as well-known film, called That Obscure Object of Desire. I'm not going to try the French title here. We'll go with the English translation. And it is a really cool, weird flick. Of course, if it's a Buñuel movie, it has to be weird. But it's this movie about a guy who is in love with this woman who seems to treat him kind of differently, and he can't quite understand her, and he becomes obsessed with her, and she seems to reject him or not reject him. And in kind of a Bergman-esque twist, she's played by two different actresses. It's a very strange movie. It starts off just completely out of nowhere, and then we kind of go back and learn why the initial events are happening, and it has a really shocking and bizarre ending. But it's so good. I mean, Buñuel, when he was on, he was so good at capturing a bunch of different types of human experience all kind of muddled within the same scene, and here we have it. It's really interesting the way that this movie is all about misunderstanding and people not being able to understand one another, which is a common theme for Buñuel, and it works well with his weird, surrealistic kind of images. And this one is a little bit more straightforward than some of his other films. You know, it's certainly not a pure surrealist film, and it's even, you know, more sensical than a movie like The Discreet Charm, where it's just constantly weird stuff and dreams within dreams and other kind of things. Is that Obscure Object is more straightforward, very, very psychological, all about these two characters and getting inside their heads and how neither one really understands the other and the problems that it causes, the two of them. But a really great film and one definitely worth seeking out.
I'm glad you picked that one because I regret to say, to my shame, I haven't seen it yet, but you know, hopefully with La Talante and Ivan the Terrible, I don't entirely have to give up my membership to Film Snobs Association. Anyway, my number two, however, is Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in America, and I talked about this back in episode 22. Is my number one pick for the movie where the cut you see is important, so you got to see the right version. But I'll just refer you back to there for most of my comments about it, just in the interest of time. But I just want to reiterate, it is really, really remarkable that Leone is an Italian director, and he reinvented, in a sense, two American genres. He took on the Western with A Fistful of Dollars and The Good and the Bad and the Ugly and so on, and then he takes on the gangster genre and makes one of the genre's, you know, greatest films. It's just, wow.
Yeah. Well, my number two is the last film by Krzysztof Kieślowski, the great Polish director we've talked about before, and his last film was a French movie, which is actually the end of a trilogy. So the trilogy pretty much all released right about the same time. The final part is called Red, released in 1994, and you could really take the entire Three Colors trilogy, but it works out that Red is the last part, his last film, and the best in that trilogy, though you shouldn't watch it until you've seen the first two. Just a wonderful movie that combines all these different characters that we've seen grow throughout this trilogy with a strange and fun love story, and just is the best of what Kieślowski did, which is wonderful images to illustrate these really smaller stories about people and where they relate to lives, and just a constantly visually fascinating and stimulating way. So definitely, if you haven't seen Red, boy, go find that, the Three Colors trilogy, watch them all. Oh, what a great way to finish a career.
Yeah, very, very great way to go out on a career. That brings me to my number one, and it's another situation where if you think in terms, it's hard not to, but if you think in terms of the director's greatest work, then it's not going to be the most intuitive picks, but don't do that. I think if you take David Lean's A Passage to India, which was made in 1984, his last movie, and the first movie he had made in 14 years, and you're not comparing it to Lawrence of Arabia and Bridge on the River Kwai, you realize just how great a film A Passage to India really is. I mean, it's just this wonderful, nightmarish, beautiful movie. Takes you to a place that is kind of, it almost doesn't feel like it exists. Basically, the setup is that this woman goes to visit a place in India, and it's a very exotic, ancient place. I read a review somewhere where somebody compared this movie to Picnic at Hanging Rock by Peter Weir, and that's about a bunch of people at a school going to a place where something just not quite real happens, and you don't really know what it was. Dark emotions just suddenly kind of took control of logic, and you don't have a reality anymore. You just have something where something a little strange happens psychologically, and it bleeds over into the, I don't know what I'm saying this well or not, but it's hard to convey that sense. I mean, that's why we have movies, to convey that sense for you and show you things that words are clumsier at expressing. But A Passage to India has an episode like that, where a woman doesn't quite know what happened. She thinks she knows what happened, then she doesn't, and then she doubts herself, but something obviously very intense happens to a woman, and she doesn't know how to process it emotionally. And we don't know either. We have no idea what that experience suddenly was, and then the rest of the movie is her trying to sort that through, and she ends up actually crying rape. And we're pretty sure a rape didn't happen, but who knows what really did happen to her. And the movie kind of examines the fallout of that charge, not only for her, but obviously for the character being accused of it. And so we have this very intimate, psychological, internal type of story told in the framework of one of David Lean's huge epics. And this is what he was great at, is making epic films that were very personal. But it goes without saying, beautiful music, beautiful visuals, great place, lush scenery, and it really sets the tone for just kind of an intense story about the parts of people that you don't really understand. So I guess that's the best way I can express it. Just go see the movie and you'll get a much more eloquent expression of the ideas there.
Well, you know, you picked a film from David Lean. You say, you know, it's not his best film. Well, my number one is this director's best film. And because it's his only film, it's something I should have picked back in episode 9 and somehow regrettably missed. Well, I can make it up now. And that is, I'll bet you figured it out. It's Night of the Hunter from 1955 by the actor Charles Laughton, who only got to make one film because for some reason this was just a bomb critically and commercially when it was released. And yet now is so well respected as just a great expressionistic noirish thriller. I mean, here's a movie that perfectly captures in its every scene the feeling and just this weird biting terror of a nightmare. It stars Robert Mitchum as this guy who poses as a preacher. He has so famously love and hate tattooed on each of his knuckles. And he goes back and marries this widow because he's trying to get the fortune that her husband stole and buried. And he kills her and begins terrorizing the children to find the location of it. And, ooh, boy, the weird journey that they take down this strange, twisting, nightmarish river is just such a fantastically weird, wonderfully freaky movie. It's so unique. It's one of the most interesting visual films to come out of the 1950s in America, for sure. It really feels more like a film from the 20s in Germany, or maybe from the 1940s. It's in beautiful, gorgeous black and white, and Mitchum gives, well, quite possibly his best performance and one of his most memorable, as this preacher who's just out for money and is completely ruthless. And even silent screen star Lillian Gish shows up in a wonderful supporting role as this sort of kind, matronly woman who can sling a rifle if she absolutely needs to. It's such a shame that it was Lawton's only picture that he was able to direct, because it's not just a really good film, it's a great one, and it's one whose director displays a remarkable knack for visuals and pacing. And gosh, what a tragedy that it was his only movie.
Yeah, it is a one of a kind, and you can see why, if studio executives really are only interested in doing what was successful before, why they wouldn't take too kindly to this movie. Because, you know, you say it comes out of the 20s or maybe the 40s or something, and yet, at the same time, it doesn't feel like either one of those things. It certainly owes a lot to expressionism, but I don't think there's another movie that is done with in quite this way and with this kind of storytelling style behind it. It's a real oddball, but certainly Laughton was, he was a visionary, and we'll never know what he might have done with other movies. So let's recap. My number 6 choice was François Truffaut's Confidentially Yours, made in 1983. My number 5, Jean Vigo's L'Atalante, made in 1934. My number 4, Michael Curtiz's The Comancheros, made in 1961. Number 3, Sergei Eisenstein's Ivan the Terrible Part 2, released in 1958, but actually made quite a bit earlier, in the early 40s. Number 2, Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in America, which took him some, 10 or 11 years to make, but it was released in 1984. and only recently available in the cut that it should have always been in, and number one, David Lean's A Passage to India from 1984.
And my top six directorial swan songs begins with Robert Altman's final film, A Prairie Home Companion, from 2006. Number five is Cecil B. DeMille's last feature, The Ten Commandments, from 1956, a remake of his own earlier silent film. Number four is the film that Sam wishes he could have from me, the 1972 film Sleuth by Joseph Mankiewicz. Number three is the last film by Louise Buñuel, That Obscure Object of Desire from 1977. Number two is the final part of the Three Colors trilogy and the last film by Krzysztof Kieślowski, Red, from 1994. And my final directorial swan song is the one and only film by the actor-director Charles Laughton, who made The Night of the Hunter in 1955.
It's time for our weekly trivia question about the movies, wherein I ask you a trivia question about the movies. And this week's trivia question about the movies is about a particular movie that... Well, okay, this is going to sound pretty obscure, but bear with me here. Okay, 11,111 frames into the movie. So that's 11111. There's a shot down a crowded city street that, if you count all the people, you can see 111 of them. So that's pretty weird in itself. But you also see on a building the street number 11. And so there's three different ways that you can get all ones in numbers. One of those numerology kind of weird things. So there's a movie like that. I'm sure you can guess this, Stephen. I mean, this is in every trivia book ever. I'm pretty sure you can. I hope you can get it. Anyway, we'll get back to it later at the end of the show.
Continuing the discussion about various things related to filming movies that cinematographic, a word I can't pronounce, we're going to talk about hopefully one of the final basic photographic terms, and that is this idea of aperture. The aperture is the opening in a lens. It controls how much light is let through. This mechanical diaphragm, which looks like this hole that can get bigger or smaller mechanically. It's like this weird... It's really hard to describe it. It makes perfect sense once you see an image of it. So maybe we'll have one of those in the show notes. There's a great image on Wikipedia that makes it very clear. Anyway, the point is the aperture is a little hole that controls how much light gets through the lens to the shutter. Well, past the shutter onto the eventual film. And so it's adjustable via this little diaphragm. And basically, the bigger the aperture, the more light that gets through. The smaller the aperture, the less light gets through. So one of the confusing things, if you start, you know, reading about photography or cinematography, when they start talking about aperture, is it's described by this weird number, which is called the F number. And it's basically the focal length of the lens divided by the diameter of the aperture. And essentially, it's got to do with the relative size of the diameter. So you always see it written as F slash a number. And so it's basically a division problem, meaning the smaller the number, the more light that's getting through. So the smaller the number, the bigger the aperture. Now, it's a little confusing, but remember, it's a division problem. Essentially, it's a way to express the relative size of the aperture related to the focal length. And that's going to be important. And you'll also hear this expressed as the F stop, because most camera lenses have these series of stops where the diaphragm stops, and for some complicated reasons that involve powers of the square root of 2, and I know I'm not making that up, each f-stop is half as much light as the one before it. So each stop up has half as much light in it as the one before it. A little confusing. Just recognize when people talk about f-stops, they're talking about the aperture size, and the smaller the number after the f, the more light that's getting through. And this is going to be really important because the aperture is going to be one of the main ways that we affect the amount of light that gets into the film in movies. In traditional photography, you can adjust the shutter speed as well, but it doesn't really get used in film because we've got to take so many pictures constantly, right? We've got to be at 24 frames a second. So the aperture size can be one of the big ways we control how much light gets in. Remember when we talked about Stanley Kubrick's films, we talked about that movie Barry Lyndon, which was famous for shooting all sorts of things in very natural light. Well, that has the largest aperture lens used in any sort of a commercial film ever. It had a ratio of f0.7, which is a really, really large aperture. A lot of light gets let in. And in addition to letting light in and just making it more easy to shoot low light conditions, that kind of stuff, larger apertures also distort images in a way one of the main things that makes up depth of field, which we've talked about before, is also the aperture size. Obviously, the focal length, like we've mentioned, affects depth of field, but also the aperture size. Larger apertures have narrower depths of field, and this just basically has to do with the way that focusing light works. As you start letting more and more light in, basically you get less focus for every ray of light that comes in. So if you have a really wide aperture, it's much harder to get things in focus. You can pick one object to have in focus. You can't have a whole bunch of things. So when we talk about deep focus, for instance, like when we talked about that with regard to something like Citizen Kane, well, one of the ways you achieve that is by shooting everything with a very small aperture, a higher f-stop. So now obviously that requires you have more light because you're going to have less light getting through, but now everything becomes very sharp. And as well, in addition, aperture size is just one thing that affects depth of field. The focal length of the image is going to be the other big thing as well. So you'll hear this talked about a lot if you study photography. Not quite as talked about necessarily in most discussions of cinematography, just because they tend to be a little less technical, but if you're reading technical discussions of cinematography or cinematic techniques, you will all the time see basically two things get talked about in terms of how you control the image. You see the lens type, the focal length, as well as the aperture size. So an important thing to know.
I have a real weakness that I have to confess to you for jungle movies, which is, you know, Stephen's fond of making fun of me for, I don't know why. You know, the king of the jungle movie is Tarzan, a character created by Edgar Rice Burroughs for his series of pulp novels, and dozens of movies have been made about him, mostly having nothing to do with the Edgar Rice Burroughs character, but, you know, the typical movie Tarzan is illiterate. The me Tarzan, you Jane type, even though that's one of the movie misquotes. He never actually said me Tarzan, you Jane, but you know, that was the idea. Well, the Tarzan of the books was brought back to England to be educated at Oxford and then chose to return to the jungle, so he was well-educated and literate a character. But the movies are a whole different ballgame, and although probably only about five of the Tarzan movies are very good or great movies, so we'll mention what those are, but I have a real fondness for, like, all of them. You know, I can't imagine a cooler way to live than in a humongous multi-level treehouse with pulleys and ramps and things that operate by live elephant. I mean, that's cool, right? Well, anyway, let's talk about the Tarzan of the movies. The first Tarzan movie was made in 1918. It was called Tarzan of the Apes with Elmo Lincoln. And that's actually still available today, and pretty good, actually. But sporadically, over the next 20 years, different people made Tarzan movies and also serials, where you'd see a new chapter of the story every week at the theater. But they all featured the dumbed-down version of the character, and that really annoyed Edgar Rice Burroughs. So he produced his own serial called The New Adventures of Tarzan in 1935. It's no longer new. But that would feature the character as he envisioned him, as a literate person. Interesting, although not that great. What I really want to talk about is what we now more or less think of as the main series, the definitive Tarzan movies, which started with six big-budget films made at MGM, starting with Tarzan the Ape-Man in 1932, and they had Johnny Weissmuller. Now, he was a German Olympic gold medalist in swimming, and again, we get an uneducated type of Tarzan, but Weissmuller's portrayal was hugely popular, and this movie was surprisingly well made. So, you know, it did make occasional use of stock footage, but a lot of it was shot on location in a jungle, which for the time was pretty incredibly rare. It was just very expensive to get into the jungle and shoot. It's much easier to put up some jungle vines on a soundstage and shoot there. For the most part, these movies were made in the backlot, as I say. But then they insert shots of stock footage, very badly inserted. So, you know, all the characters would be hacking away through a flat, very dense jungle and then look off screen. And we cut to some hippos in a wide open mountainous swampland, and then we cut back and the characters move on. Not very good. And the early Weissmuller films do have that in places, but they are actually pretty visually impressive overall. So anyway, this is the movie that made the movie Tarzan famous, and that famous yell. Became not only Weissmuller's trademark, but Carol Burnett's, too, on her show. Earlier Tarzan movies had different interpretations of the yell, and they sound really weird and goofy now, because I think because Weissmuller's yell is what we know now and identify with. But, you know, there's stampeding elephants saving the day and swinging around on vines and all the things that make living in the jungle such a wonderful fantasy. Yes, That is cool. Instead of the bug-ridden, you know, fever-ridden misery it probably really is. I mean, the jungle probably is not a very pleasant place to be, but in the movies, you can make anything look great. So we get a rare situation, actually, where we have a sequel that's better than the original. For the next movie, Weissmuller and Maureen O'Sullivan teamed up again for a movie called Tarzan and His Mate, which is actually genuinely a great entertainment. This is probably the best Tarzan movie, and it is one of very, very few that's a really great movie. Great story, great action. And as the series went on, it used humor more and more to relieve the tension. But in these first two movies, it kept things pretty tense. They had an edge to them. But you can also tell exactly when the Hays production code went into effect. We talked about that recently. Because in the next movie, Tarzan escapes. Tarzan and Jane are covered up a lot more. And this is crossing the point at which the Hays code took effect. And the fourth movie had to be very carefully entitled Tarzan Finds a Son, because Tarzan and Jane weren't, after all, married. They couldn't have a son. They had to find one in the jungle and adopt him. Actually, it's remarkable that these movies could show them living together at all, but they got away with it somehow. The sixth movie, Tarzan's New York Adventure, is kind of a neat one for bringing the character back to civilization and encountering things like skyscrapers and hotels for the first time. That's kind of fun. Elmo Lincoln has a cameo in that one, by the way. But anyway, after that, Maureen O'Sullivan decided to quit. She's actually the mother of Mia Farrow, that you may know. But anyway, she decided to quit, and MGM decided they would quit too if they couldn't make it without her. So the series moved to RKO, which at the time was a studio with a lot less money going around to make movies. They made more B-movies. And a producer there, Saul Lesser, got his hands on the series and then basically spent the rest of his life making these movies. Up until then, he'd been making these Poverty Row imitations of Tarzan, but now he got to work with Weissmuller and Johnny Sheffield, who played Boy, the adopted son. He never did find a steady actress to play Jane. Brenda Joyce was in a few. And others just appeared, you know, one time each. The budgets at RKO didn't allow for a lot of visual innovation, a lot of stock footage, very cheap productions, and not very good unless you're like me, in which case you enjoy them anyway. But he produced six more with Weissmuller, including one in 1943 where Tarzan got to fight Nazis. I'm not kidding. But then nine more with other actors after that. So, you know, in all honesty, not very good. They're just guilty pleasures. Because they became pretty formulaic and forced and mechanical, and even after switching to color and widescreen, which forced them to throw out their stock footage, didn't help. So Lesser gave up and sold the series to a guy named Cy Weintraub in 1959, and this is a good thing, because Weintraub immediately started changing things up. First, Tarzan was going to be a literate guy. Second, no more stupid slapstick for the kids. Third, they got an A-list director, John Guillermin. He hired good actors, including, Anthony Quayle. You might know that name. You definitely know the name Sean Connery. He appeared as one of the villains in this. And the result was Weintraub's first movie, called Tarzan's Greatest Adventure, almost is. This is actually a really tense suspense movie with a pretty interesting story. It has these three separate groups of people playing cat and mouse with each other in the jungle. The guy playing Tarzan was Gordon Scott. He actually just died a few months ago, I think. And it turned out to be he was really good at playing a guy who is polished and civilized in one sense, but also has this really savage side to him, and he can flip back and forth between the refined gentleman and the primitive beast pretty convincingly. And the next movie was pretty good, too, Tarzan the Magnificent. It did not star Sean Connery. Weintraub wanted him to get him back, but Connery had to send his regrets and saying, well, these two fellows took out an option on me for some spy picture, and they're exercising it, but I'll be in your next movie. Of course, he wasn't in his next movie. Not sure why. Anyway, Weintraub would make about five more Tarzan movies with different actors playing the character. And, so, you know, some of these have good visuals to them, but the series kind of became mechanical again and kind of a bit more boring, even though they had some more location shooting to them and so forth. Actually, speaking of Bond, they kind of tried to imitate him. This is really strange when franchises do this. I mean, Tarzan, you got a guy living in a jungle, and you're going to imitate Bond by giving him gadgets, and you know, I don't know why that anybody thought it was a good idea, but we're really talking about very unimportant movies now. But just to talk about shooting on location, just in general, this would apply to any movie, really. it can be difficult to shoot on location. And definitely if you've got a jungle movie, I mean, that's logistically difficult. One of the actors playing Tarzan was named Mike Henry, and he was the last guy who played the character for Cy Weintraub, but he finally sued him over his working conditions. I mean, while shooting his three Tarzan movies kind of back-to-back on location, he had been bitten in the face by a chimp and sewn up with 20 stitches. He'd gotten food poisoning and dysentery and an ear infection and a viral infection of the liver. And, yeah, it's much safer and easier just to shoot in the back lot. But the series ends in 1968. Tarzan moves to television with a different producer and a different actor playing the role, and, you know, the rest of the Tarzan movies made periodically are pretty independent of each other. One was, you know, John Derek, directing his wife Bo Derek, made a really bad one in 1981. A better one is Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan, Lord of the Apes, 1984. A Disney animated version in 1999 is a movie I think is actually a great film and one of the more underrated of the recent Disney movies. It does a wonderful job with the story. The animation is beautiful and free and really great when animation can make use of its potential to free its characters and let them, you know, do things like swing around on vines and slide down branches and things you can't do in real life. But anyway, it's weird. We're not so crazy about the Tarzan character today, unless you're me, but it is a modern myth. There is something about it that kind of clicks with people. You know, being able to live in a nature situation and be in control of that. You normally, nature controls you. That's why we live in cities. But it's a great escapist kind of fantasy if you can just give a yell and get all the elephants to come rescue you. People who are sick of the hassle and responsibilities in society might want to, you know, go out in the jungle and live and be in control and not be at the mercy of nature and fever and bugs and whatever else. You know, go out in the jungle, wrestle crocodiles, ride around on elephants, and that's why I think there have been so many movies about this character, even if a lot of them aren't very great. But anyway, a couple of them are the early Weissmuller ones. If you can find it, Tarzan's Greatest Adventure is worth a look, and if you missed the Disney cartoon, maybe give that a shot. Well, go to our website, allmovietalk.com, and I'll link to my reviews of 38 of the 53 Tarzan movies made to date, so go there if you want to learn more. You probably don't, but humor me anyway.
We've previously talked about the birth of editing up through the sort of 1920s or 30s or so. It seems weird to split a two-part history of editing segment and have the first half only really cover the first 25 or 30 years, maybe 35 years of cinema, but that's just how important those first couple of decades were up through the sort of Soviet era of montage theory. And we're going to talk about editing since then, but I think it's really important to once again drive home how much editing changed during those first formative years, and comparatively how little it's changed since then. It's certainly changed, but we're still using a lot of the basic principles that were discovered in those very early days. So I want to always just really, you know, sort of pay homage in real sense to those early film pioneers. I think it's often easy to overlook how interesting what they came up with was, and how much of it still survives today. We're still sort of standing on their shoulders. So, anyway, right around this time in America is the American studio system, which we've talked about before in this podcast. And the editing of the old classic Hollywood is going to be fairly heavily influenced by Griffith. It's not going to be nearly as exciting and crazy as some of the Soviet and European stuff from the same period. One of the real trademarks of the Hollywood studio system is that technically the films are very smooth, but designed to be fairly unnoticeable from a technical standpoint. There's not a lot of crazy sets or camera angles and movements, generally speaking. There's a very sort of smooth, elegant feel to everything, and the stories and the actors are the king. Style is going to be secondary. So when we'll talk about the American studio system, we talk about, you know, use of a lot of the standard kind of editing that had grown up by that point in time, but we don't necessarily think of it as a time of a lot of dynamic changes in editing, just because that's sort of the norm for this period. It's going to last from maybe the late 20s, early 30s, up through the end of the 40s, sometime into the 50s era. So in America during that time, not going to be super dynamic in terms of editing, mainly just sort of, like I said, standing on the shoulders of previous editors. What's really going to change things is the new wave in Europe, starting in France in the very late 1950s. Discussed it before, and one of the things the new wave is going to be all about as it starts in France and spreads to the rest of Europe is that it's okay to call attention to film technique. This is, you know, directly opposite to the ideals of the American studio system, where technique should be subdued. We're going to be very kind of in your face, so to speak. We're going to make it clear that you're watching a movie. So part of what they're doing is just rethinking traditional storytelling methods. So we're going to see a lot of editing that's really, well, really interesting. We talked before about the idea of the jump cut, and that's going to be really kind of first used to great effect by the French filmmakers, particularly in Godard's Breathless. The jump cut, and we've mentioned this before in the Film Buffs Dictionary, but it's if you show a single continuous action and just take out parts of it. So you show somebody walking down a street in a single shot, and then like you cut from him being a third to being two-thirds through the shot. So they miss that middle third, all of a sudden it's just gone, and it looks like he jumped from one place to another. So this is a kind of thing that is very, very attention-grabbing. It's flashy, it's showy, it's cool. The other thing they're going to do, sort of in a similar fashion, is heavy elliptical editing. We talked about this last time, this idea that you can cut out story details through editing. You don't need to show everything. Think of in Rescued by Rover, we don't have to watch the dog and the master retrace every step a third time. We've seen it the first two times, so we just cut that out. Well, the French filmmakers and the European filmmakers in the 1960s are going to take that to an extreme and just say, we can cut in the middle of a conversation to a totally different scene, as long as we've got the point of that conversation. We can cut in the middle of action to something completely disparate. So there's going to be a real sense in New Wave editing, and later on in American editing, that it's fine to have your shots be really contrasting. You can have your cuts really contrast exactly what came before it, really comment what came before it, or just completely drop something before. We've talked about that too in the French New Wave segment. And so this, of course, eventually transfers over to Hollywood in the 1970s. Well, you know, late 1960s, really. You think of a film like The Graduate from 1967, which has a very, very new wave feel to it, and there are some really, really interesting montage sequences there. Mike Nichols, director of the film, very heavily influenced by French cinema. This is a very sort of Frenchish kind of movie, I think, in a lot of ways, but there's these great montages where the Dustin Hoffman character, like, literally, he's walking like through a door, and all of a sudden, in what seems like a seamless cut, he's, you know, in a completely different location. But it seems like he's had a single shot, but really there was a cut, and it calls attention. You know, he's like walking out of a pool into a house, and all of a sudden he's in a completely different house. And it's a crazy, trippy effect that we get in The Graduate, and we get in other movies at this time, really. And in, as the 1970s starts featuring more kind of psychedelic, strange American films, this becomes absolutely okay to do this kind of stuff, to really call attention to editing once again. And in its own way, these techniques of the new wave and the American cinema of the 1970s are really kind of as pioneering and as interesting as must have been like watching Griffith edit a movie back in the 1910s. Just, I can only imagine how early film audiences reacted to, say, cross-cutting and real parallel storytelling and editing. It must have been amazing and fantastic and really get your blood moving. And it's the same way in a kind of different sense, but very similar in the 1970s in Hollywood. And I think all of this leads to what I describe as a more aggressive editing style in American films by the end of the 1970s. You start feeling like we can cut a lot quicker. We can have shorter shots. You know, one of the things that classical Hollywood is going to be known for are very long takes. And even to an extent, European cinema during the New Wave is still going to have a lot of long, kind of fluid takes. Well, the 1970s in Hollywood keeps really, really playing around with editing to the point we start getting shorter and shorter takes. So obviously, as the length of the take decreases, the complexity of editing increases. You got to put together more takes. It becomes harder to do, more work, more setups involved to capture all these different angles and stuff. But you know, when you think of a flick like, say, The French Connection, which I think is one of the first real modern action flicks. The car chases in The French Connection have the beginnings of the modern action movie editing technique, where you get a lot of shots of different things happening. You can cut in on the driver and the cars. And if you just think of the development of the car chase really happens during the 1970s, you think of the modern car chase is what, like half a second of somebody's foot on the clutch, and then half a second of somebody shifting something, and then half a second of some tires somewhere, and then a tenth of a second of some dude's eyes, and then a 2-second shot of a car jumping something, right? That super intense, in-your-face, aggressive editing style. Well, I think you can see the roots of it in the 1970s. Now, nothing going to generally be as intense as that, nothing as short as what we see today, but certainly that's where it comes from.
Yeah, there's another interesting transition that happens in the 70s technologically. It's a technical thing, but because of the technology, it enabled editors to edit in different ways and try different things, and that is videotape editing. You copy your movie onto videotape, you edit there, and then you can reproduce it in film. Because up till now, editing is done basically by physically cutting the film, as we've said before, and attaching it in different ways. And there's a term used to describe one of the aspects of that process that is non-linear editing. And what that means is you don't have to edit it in order. You can start with a shot that goes in the middle, and then you can physically attach one before it and one after it and keep going like that. If you need to insert a shot, you make a cut, and then you take the physical film and attach it in the middle. And so you can do non-linear editing, and that enables editors to work in just whatever order is sort of natural. They can take their center shot and work around it instead of, well, how does it begin? So that was a freedom that they had. The problem was you cut the film enough with enough experimentation, and it's very destructive. So what came about was in the 70s was called videotape editing, and it enabled them to use a bunch of video machines. I mean, they have a lab full of, I don't know, 30 machines, or it depended. Say you had 30 machines, you had different shots in each one of them, you had them all synced up together and coordinated, so, okay, this tape's going to play and it's going to record from here to here, this other one is then going to kick in and record from here to here, and then you're recording an edited version on another tape, a blank, and then you'll be able to see what you got. The problem is, with videotape, it's linear. You got to start with the first shot, and then do the next shot, and then do the next shot. And if you get all the way through 20 shots or something, and then realize, well, I want to lengthen shot number one, or insert something between one and two, you can't do that without undoing your work and starting over. So that was a problem. And eventually what resulted in was computer-based, you know, digital editing software. So you get your shots into a computer somewhere, fire up some software, and then you can move shots around and trim them different ways and experiment and output them any number of ways you want to. And so what you get that way is a non-destructive process that is non-linear. It's sort of like a word processor as opposed to a typewriter. You can move words around in a word processor and insert things back at the beginning and try things different ways. And so this is all the technical process of editing, but what may be important to understand is that it made certain types of editing easier or harder to do, and that is a bit reflected in the movies that were made during these times when these different techniques were in use. So it's interesting to think about in that respect too. Oh, and another thing is the way editors thought about what they were piecing their movies together with. Like an experienced film editer wouldn't really think in terms of time. He'd think in terms of space. He'd say, oh, I need about 2 feet of a close-up, so 2 physical feet of film. And he'd have an intuitive understanding, if he had enough experience, about how long that would last on screen. Whereas a videotape editor isn't able to hold something in his hands. He has to think in terms of time. So you got editing in space and editing in time. It was also a big transition when you went to videotape.
Yeah, and that change, I think, is reflected somewhat in the real change in American editing styles that's going to come about in the 1980s, in no small part because of the advent of the music video. This is the MTV decade, and suddenly there's this call for this whole new format, the music video, which is essentially a short little mini movie set to song with often no actual dialogue. And, you know, I think sometimes we tend to dismiss music videos, but you gotta have people to make these, right? You gotta have people to direct them, people to cut them, people to put them together. And so it creates this whole new industry in the 1980s of people. And this is gonna have a real big effect on film at this time because music videos are really, really hip, right? I mean, this is what kids are watching, this is what mass culture is all about. And so one of the things that music videos are going to do, though, is they're very, very short. You have to kind of tell some sort of story in, you know, the length of a song. And, you know, 1980 songs are going to be fairly short, so what do you got? You got 2.5 to 4 minutes or so to tell some sort of story. Well, one thing that's going to happen is this advent of the so-called the MTV style editing, which is this really, really, really quick editing with lots of quick cuts. Because when you're not using dialogue, right, you don't really have to worry so much about length of shots. You don't have to have that same sort of narrative cohesiveness that you would otherwise have in film. You've just got lots and lots of quick things to do, and you're just trying to convey mood almost as much as actual narrative. And so we get a lot of directors that come from music videos, guys like Michael Bay, you know, the huge action director today, or Spike Jonze, who's done films like Adaptation and Being John Malkovich, guy like David Fincher, Panic Room and Fight Club and Seven, and even somebody like McG, who did like the Charlie's Angels movies and stuff. A lot of very, you know, A-list directors today all got their start making music videos. Also, I think Guy Ritchie, right, the guy who did like Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch, and these are prominent directors of the 1990s and the, you know, the 2000s, who all came from the music video world, and it really shows it sometimes in their films.
It definitely shows.
I mean, look, you watch a Michael Bay movie, what's everyone say? He cuts too much. He's got too many of these so-called smash cuts, the things just hitting, cutting from one shocking thing to another shocking thing. And when I describe the half a second shot of somebody's shifting, that's a Michael Bay trademark, almost the incomprehensible put-together car chase. But absolutely, these guys have affected editing. They've affected the way that we watch movies and the way that we absorb them. So, you know, people who were raised in the late 70s, early 80s, 90s, and beyond, I think, you know, probably can parse these a little bit better than audiences previously. If you grew up watching MTV, then it's not that much of a stretch to go and watch Michael Bay's The Rock and be okay with it, whereas to people who are a little older, you know, I hear people say, oh, you know, they get motion sickness watching some of these movies. Well, I don't know, I got kind of motion sick trying to watch Paul Greengrass's car chase in The Bourne Supremacy, but what are you going to do? So, this very, very super aggressive editing style, even more so than the aggressiveness of editing in the 1970s. And I think it kind of leads us into the present, which is we kind of accept a lot of editing styles. You know, you don't get, generally speaking, in a romantic comedy, the Michael Bay editing style. I mean, gosh, I hope not, right? But, you know, it's a lot more of the classical look. But we have no problems walking out of the latest Catherine Zeta-Jones romantic comedy into Transformers and watching these, you know, half-second shots of robots' fists moving somewhere and then a second shot later of some robot getting hit by something, whatever. We're okay with that. I think modern audiences are really attuned to watching all sorts of crazy editing styles. We accept a lot of differences. And, you know, like Sam mentioned, the development of computer editing stuff where it's even easier. Just think about how you can go watch movies on YouTube that are done by 15-year-olds with iMovie on their Macintosh, and they can edit right then and there and really play around with stuff. So I think probably going to see more experimentations with editing as it becomes easier and easier to do, much, much quicker. You know, sooner or later, we're going to get like some sort of real-time editing at a decent resolution. And I don't know, where do you see the future of editing going, Sam?
Oh, yeah, definitely all online and computer stuff. As I said, the digital editing software is sort of the word processor, and we have not gotten rid of the word processor, really been able to improve upon it other than just adding features. And so I think we're just going to be using computers and developing software to enable editors to do fancy things fast, things that they would take a long time to do. I mean, even a dissolve, if you think about it, in the world of film would have been difficult. You got these two shots, you stick them together, that's a cut. If you want to dissolve so that one fades into the other, you got to send it to the lab. In a computer, you hit a button, and it's done. So, yeah, it's just so much easier to do crazy things, and we're seeing a lot of crazy things getting done.
Yeah, and hopefully in the future we'll get down to the hundredth of a second shot being the standard. I really look forward to that.
Oh, I hope so.
That'd be great.
I hope so.
It'll just be, the films we watch will just be a blur of indistinguishable images, and it'll be really exciting. It's a brave new world out there, folks.
It's the end of the show, and I had a trivia question at the beginning, if you can remember back that far. If you're not the star of Memento, you probably can, but it's, 11111 frames into the movie, you can see 111 people and the number 11. Steven, just lay it on me. What is it? What is this movie I'm talking about? It's so easy. I was really hoping you'd know this.
300?
No, I don't think so.
It's a movie about numbers?
I think that's...
Or something.
You sure you don't know this?
It doesn't ring a bell.
Really?
Yeah.
That's kind of disappointing because I was hoping you'd tell me. I'm not really sure what it is myself.
I'm sorry?
I have no idea what the answer is to this. I was hoping you'd know, because I've been curious about this for about 11 days.
I'm going to hurt you.
What?
You just asked me a question you don't know the answer to?
I was hoping you'd tell me. I've been very curious about this.
That's not how that's supposed to work.
Oh. We already have the first part of the episode recorded, so...
I mean, it's too late to edit it. These are all live to tape, so...
Yeah. Really? You sure I can't ask you something like that?
Well, you can ask me. I can't answer it.
So I can't ask you?
Well, obviously, you have.
So... Oh.
I think we should just cut our losses and say that the answer is Batman.
Alright, Batman it is. So if you guessed that at home, playing our home trivia game, score yourself a point.
So hopefully you know everything you want to know about both editing and Tarzan, both vital subjects for every film buff. Anyway, that's it for the show this week. What's not over is the movie website, allmovietalk.com, completely unaffiliated with our show, actually. Just coincidentally has the same name, and they happen to host our podcasts, but a great blog there by two of the smartest and most informed and also good-looking guys out there when it comes to the world of movie criticism, which isn't saying all that much.
And also check out rinkworks.com, RINKWRRKS.com. Next time I make a website, I'm going to pick one that I'll have to spell. Episode 48, I believe, is up next week, and that'll be for August 28th, 2007. So mark that date on your calendars. That's when you go get episode 48 and listen to us talk about John Ford. Yes, we got another great director. We're sort of playing catch-up with these director spotlights, but John Ford made a whole lot of movies, and a lot of them are really brilliant. And also, our top six list, if you're playing along with our top six movie home game, where you, I guess, just pick your own six for the topic for next week, and then... not sure how you win the game. Actually, I do know. You post them to the website and get a discussion going.
So Joe, I'm 18, is the undisputed champion?
Yeah, you got to beat him, people. Come on.
Good luck.
But yeah, our top six topic is going to be unfairly maligned films. Movies that we think are unfairly attacked for one reason or another. Maybe because they're just we think they're better than they're generally considered, but it might be a more specific aspect of the movie, too, that just gets attacked, and we think that's unfair. So think about that, and we'll get to that next week.
Ooh, 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 ooh. Me, Jane, you talk... Cut!